This is Book Talk from Scottish Book Trust. I'm Paul Gallagher, and joining me to do some book talking this month are Peggy Hughes, City of Literature's Communications Executive, and Duncan Wright, Senior School Librarian from Stuart's Melville College in Edinburgh. We're going to be discussing our featured book, Boxer Beetle, the debut novel from 26-year-old English author Ned Bowman. And then we'll hear from Bowman himself in an interview we recorded for Book Talk a few weeks ago. But before all that, I'm going to give you, the listener, a chance to win a copy of Boxer Beetle. To have a chance of winning one, you just have to tell us which classic novel opens with this line.
First is a foreign country, they do things differently there.
If you can tell us where that opening line comes from, and I'm pretty sure you can, email the answer to booktalk@scottishbooktrust.com along with your name and location. Now, I said on the last podcast that we'd announce last month's winners on this one, but actually, due to the time that we're recording this, I don't know who those winners are yet. So instead, we'll post the winners' names on the website at scottishbooktrust.com/booktalk. So, to Ned Bowman's novel, Boxer Beetle. The story begins in the present day when Kevin, an amateur collector of rare Nazi memorabilia, goes in search of a missing private investigator on the instructions of his sometime employer, Grublock. When the investigator turns up dead, Kevin, also nicknamed Fishy due to a rare condition that causes his sweat to smell of fish, realizes there is more going on than he first thought. The story then flashes back to 1930s New York, and we're introduced to Seth Sinner Roach, the boxer of the title. He's short, gay, Jewish, and yet supremely self-confident, and a near unbeatable fighter. He's approached by Philip Erskine, a scientist who has been studying beetles and is a firm proponent of eugenics, with a keen desire to make a scientific study of Sinner. What follows is part absurd historical comedy, part present-day mystery chase story, and all quite, as many of the critical quotes on the book's jacket claim, dazzling. So, Peggy, as I've just referred to there, the book begins with six pages of glowing critical quotes, as well as an opening blurb that states in no uncertain terms, although with tongue quite clearly in cheek, that this book is clever, distinctive, and entertaining. So my first question to you is, were you dazzled by Boxer Beetle?
Well, first of all, I'll say that I loved how kind of the quotes were kind of shouted across the first two pages, that they just felt like they were screaming in your face, read this book, it's so enjoyable. Mm-hmm. And on his website, he quite humorously, I think, picks dazzling four times. So I really like that. I'm not sure if dazzled's the right word. For me, I think I was really entertained. I was quite compelled to finish it, despite the kind of less pleasant aspects of it, maybe. I was impressed with his confidence. It's a very assured debut, I think. But I'm not sure I was completely dazzled.
Duncan, how about you?
I didn't think it lived up to the hype. And interestingly, I actually hated the shouting in the first couple of pages. Whereas Peggy thought it was great, I just thought, what are you trying to tell me here? Why do you need to shout this out to me? I found the book interesting. I have to say, it's not the kind of book I would have picked up necessarily off the shelf. Just reading it's not even a blurb on the back, it's more of a quote. Reading that, I would have probably put it straight back down. A collector of Nazi memorabilia, a nine-toed gay Jewish boxer, a 1930s aristocrat with a yen for eugenics, Ned Bowman's time-travelling debut takes a cast list from the film Tarantino never made and add perhaps the creepiest MacGuffin of all time. A swastika marked beetle, the anophthalmos Hitler eye.
Well pronounced.
You think I'd practice that? I would have probably put that straight back down, but saying that, there was elements I found interesting. I was compelled to finish it, but there were parts that I thought were maybe weaker than others.
Just to sort of give people an idea of really what to expect from this book, because even though we've sort of read a few quotes there, and I've done a bit of a kind of plot precis, at least the start of it, I don't really think we've yet conveyed what the kind of tone and the overall sort of feeling is. So, Peggy, how would you kind of sum up, if you could, what's really going on here?
I think it's difficult because there's so very much going on with it. Like, he tries to do loads of stuff. There's kind of quite different narrative time frames. The present day with Fishy and his extremely bizarre and unscrupulous boss. So that's one, how it begins. But then it casts all the way back in time to the 30s and to Sinner Roach and in the boxing ring, and it plunges you straight in there.
I find that the modern day timeline is quite infrequent, and by the time you come back to the modern day timeline, you've almost forgotten whereabouts you were, and you're almost flicking back through the pages. There's also a random point where we go even further back in time and we meet Erskine's father, and we go back to the late 1800s, and I didn't really see where that fitted in at all.
I actually really like that chapter. I don't know that I could narratively justify it and tell you why it's there. His father was really interested in possible made-up languages. Mm-hmm. It's quite funny the way it concludes about his wife kind of having a sort of affair, but not really, because she got interested in a different made-up language. Like, I mean, I thought that was pretty funny. It did remind me a little bit of, and there's other references to the same author in here, it reminded me a little bit of a Paul Auster book, New York Trilogy, which has stuff about made-up languages in it. And to be honest, I would say that what Boxer Beetle does is kind of a pale imitation of what Paul Auster does. But still, there were interesting ideas there. And I think, Peggy, it's interesting that you said he tries to do a lot. I think that probably is the right way to say it.
I think I sort of went on a massive tangent there about narratives, but I mean, in terms of what to expect, what else is there? There's what Scarlett Thomas in The Guardian called a tragically doomed love story between Sinner Roach and I bring that up because I think that's an interesting way to look at it, between Sinner and Dr. Erskine. I wouldn't have seen that as a love story, so that's one thing. There's obviously this exploration of eugenics, the black shirts and Nazism, the rise of fascism. There's Beatles galore. There's boxing. There's lots and lots of gore and blood. It's not for the faint of heart.
Just to touch back on the idea of themes, I think in my notes I listed sort of 10 different themes which came up, you know, including things such as new towns, which...
Cumbernauld, what's it called? Cumbernauld, it was in there, I was excited.
So the new towns, the eugenics, the language, the Nazism, the homosexuality, the class system is mentioned, fascism, there's so many things, and almost in a way I felt that was possibly one of the weaknesses of the book, in that he tried to include so many different things.
But was it weak because he didn't do it well, or was it weak because it would have been stronger if he'd not done it? What do you think?
I think he did some parts of it well. I loved the historical aspect of it, and I thought he evoked the 1930s very, very well. And I thought that was one of the really strong points of it. The modern day storyline, I really struggled with that, and
I think it's because I didn't really warm to Fishy. Not because of his quite bizarre, acrid stench. more just because he was almost, you know, peripheral. I mean, in a way, he's as much a protagonist, if you like, in a more minor way. But you don't really get to know him beyond his Nazi...
No, we know nothing about
various ailments. You know, he doesn't really have any friends. There's no context for him, really.
Yeah, I found myself sort of asking, why is the modern-day story even in this book? Like, apart from giving a stronger plot line for, like, readers to be kind of running along with, the historical story, and I think I'm agreeing with what you guys are saying, the historical story is far more compelling. The historical characters are far more compelling. And the characters in the modern-day storyline, they're just ciphers. They just serve a function of, like, moving a plot forward. And I think you feel that really strongly at the end. When the contemporary story ends, it really left me feeling like, that was really about nothing. It was very empty.
I felt quite disappointed when I realised, we're going back to the...
I was very disappointed.
You know, and I kind of felt, when are we going back to the... You know, well, maybe it's because I thought Sinner was a bit of a winner, really, even though he was entirely grim and reprehensible. I thought that he was...
Let's talk about him. He's the most interesting character in the book, isn't he? Do you agree, Duncan?
Him and I find Erskine... I probably would have said I found Erskine a little bit more interesting. I find Sinner a little predictable at times. I did like him.
In a bit 2D. He's going to get drunk. He's going to punch someone.
Yes, I could see where it was coming almost. You know, when they have the scene in New York where... He sort of breaks out of the flat. I kind of could see that was going to happen. He was going to go and he was going to get drunk and he was going to go off the rails. And sometimes I felt like that was always going to be the case. But he's...
Before we get into Sinner, I want to kind of wave a little flag for Millicent and Evelyn Erskine. The sister of Dr. Erskine. Yes. I think Millicent is a Bryony Tallis, you know, from Atonement. She said, and she's got these great lines. You know, she's always kind of coming in and spying on people and coming off with these kind of completely precocious...
She did make me laugh out loud.
She's the one who declares that someone's, you know, someone's mother's just been sodomised by someone else, or you know, in some room. You know, she's completely kind of bizarre. Again, quite bizarre. What's she doing? Yes. But what's she doing there? I think Evelyn Erskine is a great unsung heroine. You know, I love the bit where we'll not mention why she is, but she's feeling quite sad, shall we say? And she says, I'm just going to off and smoke 100 cigarettes. And it just feels very...
There are lots of these. And I think, you know, having said about the present-day storyline being... I've pretty much condemned it as being pointless. But I feel like, you know, there is a lot in the past storyline in the 30s that really is worth the book existing. You know, like it's worth it is worth reading for some of those things, for some of those touches, for some of those characters. So to come to Cinna, and I'll just say why I think that he's the most interesting character. I just found him unique. He's a contradiction, you know, like there's so much about him that means that he should really be very self-analytical and very kind of insecure, you know, like, but in fact, he's supremely confident. And I couldn't explain him. And I don't think that Ned Berman tries to explain him. He just kind of like plants him in the middle of this story. And
he's kind of exposed through his actions rather than any kind of self-analysis, though. Yeah. I just feel like I was Marielle Frostrup. but you know, he is just action. I think I love there's a bit in it where I think he's somehow compared to a thunderstorm. And I love that. I just think he's almost like Holden Caulfield. Mm. Like just sort of like a malcontent like force for the bad, but also very winning in a weird way.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt he is an interesting character. I think, as I say, I did find him a little predictable. And there's also an element of, I didn't really like him. He's obnoxious. He's leery. He's just, I don't know. In a way, I suppose I felt a little bit more sympathy for Erskine, who's this much more gentle and...
Oh, but he's such a milquetoast. I really didn't like Erskine. He's not a man of action, you know.
He's certainly not a man of action, no.
And he's such a victim of circumstance, Erskine. It feels to me like things just happen to him, you know. He runs into Cinna and he's like, you know, he's tracked him down maybe. But it just feels what happens to him is so dependent on everyone else.
Yeah, Cinna does tread his own path, you know. He makes a lot more decisions, you know.
But I suppose the thing about Cinna and his, you know, attractiveness, it's because it's all seen through the people that are attracted to him. That's what's interesting about the way we get to know Cinna. You know, he's some kind of love god, you know, lots of people are drawn to him, and I think that's interesting. It doesn't need to be stated, it's done through the actions of people around him.
Yeah. The section that sort of struck me most powerfully in the book was a bit towards the end where Evelyn is drawn to reflect on Cinna's life, and she kind of has this moment of, I do not want to romanticize this man. I don't want to betray the jagged truth of his life by writing herself into a beautiful, tragic romance. I thought this was what the book was really about for me, you know, like this kind of jaggedness of a life and how that shouldn't be smoothed off and romanticized and fitted into a nice picture that you can just say, oh, that's what that was, because that's not what life is. And, you know, that sort of struck me in the midst of a book which I felt was quite, not superficial, but light, despite all its weighty ideas and things. Did that hit you guys at all?
It's interesting that Evelyn sees that, because she meets Skinner for a relatively short time. Yeah. They do have an intimate moment together, which obviously has an effect on her. But it's interesting that she still, I think there's a point where she says, you know, will I ever meet him again? And what was the chance of me ever meeting him in the first place? Yeah. He does see obviously have an effect on the people around him, and we can see that with Erskine. And
I'm just trying to find that bit about Evelyn, just because I thought that was her kind of finest hour, really.
Yeah,
you know, I just
agree.
Felt that was her kind of Hollywood moment, look to camera kind of thing. I just thought it was great that she was given that space in the book.
Obviously, we've referred to the amount of different subjects, some of them which could provoke some readers to offence, that kind of thing. I'm just wondering what you think overall of how Ned Berman handles sort of all this stuff that he kind of gives himself to deal with. It's one thing to throw it all out there, but does he really justify?
What do you mean specifically, Paul? Like that Nazism's in there and that could be offensive to...
Yes, because it's quite a light treatment when you're talking about eugenics and talking about there's discussions about kind of how Jewish people should basically, you know, it's right what the Nazis think, you know, like, and obviously I'm not saying that the book in any way endorses that, but when you're dealing with characters who are putting forward these views and it's a comedy, you know, then there's that kind of thing. And then there's the quite frank sex, you know, like it's quite explicit, which is not, it's not like that's in any way unprecedented, but I'm asking the question of whether there should be a sort of narrative justification or whether it's just okay for this kind of content to be thrown into a book, or is it, you know, like...
I did get the feeling at some points with the sex scenes that some were written for effect. There's a point where Erskine and Seth finally share, we can't call it an intimate moment because it's far from it, but I couldn't quite work out if that's how I thought it would happen or whether that's how he decided it would happen. And it's verging on violent, and we know that Seth is that kind of character, and Erskine, as we've sort of discussed, is a little bit more of somebody who just almost lets things happen. And I wonder if, did he need to do that, or could it have been done in a different way?
Are you quibbling the fact that it happened at all? and the need for that, or the way it was written? Because I think the way it was written is completely contiguous, if you like, with Sinner's previous behaviour and his proclivities to you know, the way he's dealt with all his other lovers in the book. Mm-hmm. You know,
Sinner didn't like Erskine, so why did he take that opportunity? Or,
well, I suspect that it was because there's that bit where he says, "Oh, you've wanted me all, you know, not you've wanted me all along, but you know, you own me. You might as well have all of me." That kind of sense. I assumed it was just him almost foolishly giving all of himself. It's just sex in a book.
Yeah, it's not something that's not been written before and won't be written again.
Yeah, I didn't kind of shield mine eyes. You know, it wasn't like, you know, will it win the Bad Sex Award? Who's to say?
Okay, let's conclude this discussion by just reflections on the end of the book. We've already mentioned that, I guess, at the very end of the book, we all felt a little bit disappointed by the conclusion of the contemporary section. But let's pull back to the way the story in the past winds up. There's a kind of action ending to the story. So before we get to the very end, there's something that could have been in an Indiana Jones movie that happens. That kind of seems to leap out of nowhere in terms of what's come before in the book. I wondered how you guys felt about that scene without sort of going into specific detail of what I mean by that.
That's not a reason to read it. I don't know what is. I was taken by surprise. I would say don't maybe eat while you're reading the end of the book, as I was. I think it was the big kind of Hollywood curtain coming down. You know, it did feel, and I don't know if that made it feel like it was an ending, you know, an ending of convenience or drama bolted onto the end.
I think that would have worked, the big Hollywood ending, had it built up to that in the first place. But I think with the modern day storyline, there is no build up to this big Hollywood ending. You know, it's the historical part, as we've discussed already, has much more depth to it, whereas this sort of grandiose finish comes kind of out of nowhere, and you're sitting there thinking, really?
Yeah.
Well, then certainly I was.
Are you talking about the contemporary, the actual ending, or are you talking about the bit with the Beatles?
Yeah, I'm talking about where the Beatles appear. Yeah, the Beatles appear in the book lots and lots.
I get what you're saying, though, because the contemporary storyline, it disappears from the book for so long that there really isn't a weight to it. Like, so when that comes back and this huge significant sort of action happens, it feels a bit like a sort of, it's a scene set apart from everything else. It doesn't really have a context.
I think you're not invested in it enough. And maybe that's to the praise of the historical bit, which we've already discussed. We all really liked and felt had a lot of depth to it. So maybe it's just that that bit was great, so therefore the contemporary bit wasn't so great and wasn't so frequent, so you're more detached.
We are left with a couple of loose ends with the historical ending. You know, we don't really know what happens to Erskine, you know. Yeah.
And I wanted to know, but then I'm someone who likes a thing to be all sutured up, and you're like, oh, that happened to him there. You're kind of like a montage at the end of a film. I'm a fan, you know, there they are looking all happy.
Yeah, and I think the writer obviously felt that it was fine just to leave it as it has. He'd explained what he wanted to explain, so therefore, fine, let's leave it.
Well, life isn't like that, where it's suddenly all explained away.
So I guess if you were to give a sort of brief opinion on this book, would you say yes, it's worth reading, Peggy?
I think it's not for all markets, and maybe that's because of the kind of just the violence, the kind of gore and stuff, but I would press it on people. I enjoyed it enough to say, you know, I've got a few friends in mind that I think might give it a burl. I'm going to hold up a sign so you can all see what I'd give it out of 10. A bit like you, Duncan, I don't think I would have necessarily gone for it in a bookshop, but I'm glad to have read it. I think what it's done for me is I'm excited about what Ned Bowman might do next, which is a result.
There's definitely potential there. You know, there's parts of it which are great. Dazzling? Maybe not dazzling. Interesting. It will appeal to a certain demographic, I think. You know, I could see certain people enjoying the book. But for me, somebody once said to me, you have to make a decision on whether you have enough time in your life to read a certain book. And I probably wish I hadn't read this one.
Wow.
I'm with you, Peggy. I would definitely want to read more from him, even though I find this book flawed in many ways. I do think there's a lot that I enjoyed. And he's already finished his next book, which comes out later this year. His new book's called The Teleportation Event, which I think is a great title. So, that is what we thought of Boxer Beetle. If you've read it and you want to add your comments to the discussion, you can do so at scottishbooktrust.com/booktalk. You can also tweet us your thoughts at twitter.com/booktalk_SBT. Find us at facebook.com/scottishbooktrust or email booktalk@scottishbooktrust.com. Next up, our interview with the author, Ned Bowman. This is Book Talk with me, Paul Gallagher. I had the opportunity to speak to the author of Boxer Beetle, Ned Berman, and I began by asking him where he got the idea that sparked this book.
Well, the two elements it grew out of were the beetle is based on a real beetle called Anophthalmus hitleri that was discovered by a German entomologist called Oscar Scheibel. And the boxer is based on a 19th century Australian boxer called Jim Hall. And in both cases, a lot of the stranger than fiction details are actually come straight from history. And I found both of those in the same afternoon when I was browsing Wikipedia at work. and they seemed to, and they were sort of united by this like slightly creepy collector theme, which made me think they could work together in a book. And then the whole rest of it just emerged from trying to think of a way that those two could come together.
There's something that struck me about the book that is interesting is that obviously you've got the kind of two basic time frames, and they seem quite different in that the present day story is kind of quite a plot driven sort of like MacGuffin chase type thing where characters are maybe not so important, and then the past is more of a character focused, it's more about those people. At least that's the way it kind of struck me. Would you agree that that's the way it fits together?
Yeah, I mean, like when I think about that structure, I often think whenever you read the blurb on the back of a thriller that you see in a supermarket, it always says like, and in the course of their investigation, they will discover a secret that should have stayed buried. Or like in the course of their investigation, they will discover a lie from history that no one ever expected to be revealed, or like something like that. I've never understood why that's so ubiquitous. There's obviously something incredibly appealing to the reading public about discovering something about that happened a long time ago in the course of an investigation of something that's happening now.
Right,
And I don't know why, but like, I was thinking about that structure and sort of, well, like half subverting it, but not really subverting it. I'm still basically using that structure.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was also a case of I really wanted to do like a plot driven novel, but I also really wanted to do something with like characters and ideas, and it's sort of segregating those by chronology somehow ended up being the easiest way to do both of those things.
Well, I think you pulled it off. I wanted to just ask you about the character of Sinner. To me, he was the most fascinating character and an incredibly unique character, I thought. Like, and just really interesting because he seems just completely immune to self-analysis or self-doubt in any way, which I thought was interesting for this gay Jewish boxer. You know, like it was perhaps the kind of character where you would expect a little less confidence. I wondered, you know, how you formed him, and also whether those traits come from you, that confidence.
Well, when I first conceived the book, Sinner was going to be almost a total blank. He was just going to be this sort of dead star around which everyone else revolved, and he was not going to have an inner life at all. He was just going to be like this force. But I couldn't quite be as rigorous as that when I was actually writing it. And then when I was working on the second draft with my editor at SEPTA, one of the main things we did was give him even more of an inner life, so he turned into a real character. I mean, apart from the Jim Hall, the Australian boxer, the other basis for Sinner was this real life Jewish Hoxton boxer called Jack Kidd Berg, whose memoir I drew on quite heavily. And and he was called the Whitechapel Windmill. And like Jack Berg in the memoir does have that incredible confidence. I mean, he wasn't gay, but he was like a very effective Lothario. And well, I mean, I presume it wasn't quite the same at the time, but if you're reading his voice 50 years later, he does give the impression of himself as completely untouchable and kind of in control. Yeah. So that was part of it. But then also, Synergist sort of represents pure id. So in a way, he'd like, if there's going to be a character who is sexually intimidating to Erskine, who's having his awakening, then the character who's going to be the most intimidating is a character like Cinna, who has absolutely no chinks in his armor and is absolutely sort of immune to like rational persuasion.
Thinking about that issue of confidence, continuing to think about confidence, it seems that the novel itself is very confident. Like for a debut, it's hugely confident in diving into areas which some authors would avoid. Like, you know, you've got Nazi memorabilia, fascism, gay sex. It certainly must have taken a certain confidence to put that in. Did you ever sit back and think, I'm making a huge mistake?
Well, no, because like I didn't anticipate at all that people would find it a sort of transgressive novel, because I find it so easy to think of like stuff that I'm into that goes much deeper into those areas than my novel does. So like all the Nazi stuff, like this is, you find much more shocking Nazi stuff in like Inglourious Bastards or Hellboy or even Indiana Jones or like any number of like pulp or genre novels or films. And then the gay stuff, like I'm a big Alan Hollinghurst fan, and I don't know, if you read like Burroughs or like any number of kind of experimental 20th century writers, my treatment of that is incredibly like vanilla and bland. And then it was only when it was published that I realized that if you haven't read as much of all that stuff as I have, then maybe at first glance it might be shocking. But it's, I'm really just like following the footsteps of like much earlier, much more genuinely courageous writers.
Cool. And leading on from that, I just wondered, what other books do you think that, what other books are the influences on this book? I mean, you've mentioned a few authors already.
Well, the main one pretty transparently is The Amazing Adventures of Calla and Clay by Michael Chabon, which is one of my favorite contemporary novels. And like, it's such a delightful book that I found, like, I've just found it impossible to resist its influence. So if people think it's too derivative, then I completely own up to that. And some people complain of that. And then apart from that, like, obviously there's a lot of Chandler in the present day sections. There's a lot of Evelyn Waugh in the 30 sections, like Graham Greene. I think a lot of the like moral landscape came out of that, and then like Woodhouse, and then a lot of the more postmodern elements I was thinking about, like I was thinking about DeLillo or Pynchon or the invented languages chapter is quite closely derived from a book called Gain by Richard Powers. Yeah, I think that's the bulk of it.
That's great. Do you have a particular book? I mean, obviously you mentioned Cavalier and Clay as a kind of favourite contemporary novel. Do you have a particular book that is kind of your, this is the ultimate novel?
Well, my favourite book is The Good Soldier by Ford Madox Ford, but it's my favourite book just because I feel such a like strong emotional connection with it. So it's just, that's like a very personal preference. And I don't necessarily think it's like objectively the best book. I mean, I think like, if I had to say what's the most perfect novel ever written, then I would go with the like fairly obvious answer of Gatsby. And then if I think about the kind of novel that I feel like we all aspire to as contemporary writers, then it would be something like Underworld by Delaney.
And that's all from Book Talk this month. I've asked my guests, Peggy Hughes and Duncan Wright, to come up with some related recommendations, and that list will be available at scottishbooktrust.com/booktalk. Get in touch and let us know if you agree or disagree with us about Boxer Beetle. Tweet us at booktalk_SBT. Find us at facebook.com/scottishbooktrust or email booktalk@scottishbooktrust.com. Next month on Book Talk, we'll be talking about two books. The first, another Scottish debut novel, The Echo Chamber by Luke Williams. And the second, a little-known novel called The Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins, which is apparently something of a big deal. Thanks very much to my guests today, Peggy Hughes and Duncan Wright. For Scottish Book Trust, I'm Paul Gallagher. Goodbye. Book Talk is produced by Colin Fraser, with music by Sam Gallagher.